From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, with the June primary just days away, we take a look at why some California progressives aren't very happy with Governor Jerry Brown. We'll also talk with one of the candidates who is seeking Brown's job, Republican Neel Kashkari. Later, we'll find out why the drought is making the telephone ring at one local business, and we'll get a preview of what's in store for this season's Respite by the River series of readings by local authors at the San Joaquin River Parkway. But first, on this day after Memorial Day, we launch a new series of special reports about the lives of Valley veterans. We call it Common Threads, and it's a part of the War Comes Home initiative from Cal Humanities. Our series aims to give you an intimate look at the lives of these men and women who served our country and the challenges and opportunities they've faced upon their return stateside. We hope to bring you stories that are as diverse as the Valley itself and bring you new insights into life after the wars. For some veterans, returning home from one war has meant the start of another fight, one for equality and civil rights at home. FM89's Ezra David Romero brings us the stories of two Porterville area veterans who have done just that. And in a community that made national headlines last year when the Porterville City Council revoked a proclamation declaring June Gay Pride Month, coming home and coming out have been equally challenging.
To be honest, in Porterville, I pretty much stayed in the closet until I met Brock, and you love who you love, and it's no choice.
That's John Coffey, who served in the Army during the Vietnam War from 1968 to 1971.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war.
Between my service time and through schooling, I went on to become a E5 in 5 months. And then when I came home out of the service, I got involved in my union and rose through the ranks.
You don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Coffey is retired from Porterville Unified School District, where he worked in shipping and receiving for 41 years. He lives in Porterville with Brock Neely, his husband of 5 years. He wasn't out during his time in the military.
In 1968, you definitely stayed in the closet.
Tell me about that experience. Was it hard?
Yeah, because there's a lot of good-looking people in the service. There's some that are dogs, just like in life, but there's really good-looking people, too. But you stay in the closet, and you keep your thoughts to yourself, and just don't do all that much.
The two were the first male-male couple married in Tulare County in 2008.
Well, as you can tell, I still get emotional about it because your wedding day is one of the most important days in your life. Just make the right choice. Don't rush into it, but don't be afraid. Things will work out. Do we have difficulties like any other married couple? Well, yeah. There's days I love him dearly. There's other days I'd dearly love to kill him. And I'm sure the shoe's on the other foot. But be yourself.
From their suburban three-bedroom home, Coffey and Neely took me to what they consider a sacred space in the city, the Rotary Veterans Park of Porterville.
You see the medevac chopper here in front of us, and there's a plaque that lists fatalities that Porterville had in Vietnam. Porterville had the highest death rate per capita of any city in the United States in Vietnam. I can't stand to look at the plaque because way too many of those names are people I went to school with.
But even though Coffey made it back to Porterville alive, he says he was emotionally subdued for way too long.
Well, I knew who I was probably when I was in fourth or fifth grade. When I was willing to accept it and not be hiding it, I was in my mid-50s. And a lot of that is due to this community.
He says strong Christian values in the region kept him from coming out.
By and large, the Central Valley is considered the Bible Belt of California. Tulare County is the buckle of the Bible Belt. Porterville is made up of very good people, but there are just enough of the homophobes. Just don't want to walk holding hands with your husband down Main Street unless you're heterosexual.
So why would Coffey come back to this place where he knew a gay lifestyle wouldn't be accepted? Coffey says Porterville was a welcoming place for Vietnam veterans.
I knew I was going to be safe here being a Vietnam veteran. You can't say that for every place, even in California.
Would you have felt safe if you were out at the time?
No, that one I can answer very clearly. But as a veteran, I knew I'd be protected if had to be.
Over 40 years later, Coffey says he is rarely afraid to show his true colors.
There are those few people that you have to interact with that, well, how are they going to react? I guess maybe because I'm 67, almost 68, I just don't care how they're going to react anymore. I have to be who I am. And if they have a problem with it, it's their problem, not mine.
And in this community, where LGBT rights have been looked down upon, others share a similar story. More than a decade after Coffey served in Vietnam, Connie Wilson enlisted in the Navy. Her 5 years in the military were full of inner turmoil. It wasn't combat, the sound of artillery, or fear of death that troubled her. Her greatest fear was of being outed as a bisexual.
When I was in boot camp, I had a gal that was also from Georgia, and we ended up in A school together. And that was probably the first time I had anybody make any moves on me. And it scared me because I know in the military you don't talk about it, you don't do it.
Wilson was eventually stationed in Beeville, Texas. A few months later, her friend from Georgia followed her there, but fear of coming out kept them apart.
Apparently, she went on a cruise with a few other ladies, and the word got back, and they did a major investigation on her. They were pulling everybody from the squadron, anybody that had anything to do with her. I saw how much she went through, and there was absolutely no way I was going to say anything and come out.
Wilson's fear drove her into isolation. It was so real that it took her 18 years after her stint in the Navy to embrace her sexuality.
Being able to be who I was for the first time was actually quite liberating. It was kind of like a breath of fresh air. You absolutely just don't care anymore. You finally start realizing that you can ignore the people that don't accept you.
But despite her newfound boldness, Wilson found the hardest person to confront about her sexuality was her father.
Recently told him, and he sent me a very beautiful letter. Because we're from the South in Georgia, and there's still a lot of hatred for a lot of things. And he told me that he loved me no matter what, and whoever I was with, he was absolutely fine with.
She moved from Tulare 4 years ago, where she worked in corrections. Today she works for the state, and says even though the city has a long way to go when it comes to accepting the LGBT community, she sees signs of improvement. Last year she walked with the city's first gay veteran troop during the annual Veterans Day parade in Porterville.
Towards the end of the parade, there was a gentleman that could barely, I mean, he was an older military retiree veteran, and he actually stood up and saluted us. You know, he could barely stand up, but obviously he didn't have an issue, and I think a lot of people aren't going to have an issue, but around here, nobody wants to say it. Because nobody wants to be associated or affiliated because those people aren't what we expect people to be.
And in this city that takes pride in their patriotism, Coffey and Wilson agree they wish the city would respect their civil rights just like their service. Reporting from Porterville, I'm Ezra David Romero.
Support for Common Threads comes from Cal Humanities and the War Comes Home Initiative. More information is available online at calhum.org.
Barely sleeping and you can't get through to VA on the phone. No one's hiring and no one wants to give you a goal. And everyone else is carrying on just like they've always done before. You've been home for a couple of years now, buddy, but you're still fighting the war.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. California's June primary is just days away, and one of the biggest questions is who will wind up on the November ballot opposite California Governor Jerry Brown. Our next guest hopes to occupy that slot. His name is Neil Kashkari, Republican gubernatorial candidate. Neil joins us now on Valley Edition. Neil, welcome.
Hey, thank you. It's great to be here.
Your personal background is rather different from a lot of your Republican peers, both in this election and in past ones. In some cases, the same could also be said about your politics, especially on social issues. Do you think your campaign, if successful, signals a new era for the California GOP?
Well, I hope so. I'm hoping to rebuild and grow the California Republican Party. You know, we're down to 28% registered Republicans. And if we just get those 28%, we're not going to win another election, period. what I'm trying to do is reach out to every group across California and say, if you want to work hard, if you want your kid to get a good education, and you just want a good job and a fair chance to build a better life for yourself, then we're the party for you. And I think that those ideas, those principles can unite Californians, and we can really change the state based on them.
You're the son of Indian immigrants. Your personal background, as I mentioned, is rather different than a lot of Republicans. Your time in Washington with the Treasury Department is also well documented, running the Troubled Asset Relief Program at the end of the Bush administration, the start of the Obama administration. You were still a young man at that time. You're still a young man now. How did that process shape you as a leader, and what did you learn from being in the midst of that controversial program at a time of the nation's financial crisis?
Sure. You know, that was one of the worst times economically in our nation's history, literally since the Great Depression. But that experience taught me that you can get Republicans and Democrats to work together. We did it. We got both President Bush and then Senator Obama to work together. Nancy Pelosi, John Boehner, the leaders of both parties came together, put their country before their political careers, and worked to stabilize the economy and also to protect the taxpayers. I'm proud that we got people to work together to tackle that crisis. And that's what makes me so optimistic, that if we could get Republicans and Democrats to work together in Washington, we can get them to work together in Sacramento to rebuild the middle class.
Is that why you're running for governor? The thought of a Republican candidate winning office in this state and in an office like a governor is a challenging one, has to be a big task given the voter registration edge for Democrats and Governor Brown's lead in the polls. What makes you want to be California's next governor? And were you always drawn to pursue political office or leadership in some way?
You know, my interest in government service probably first began when I was a kid. My father did research on ending poverty around the world, and he actually received an award from President George Herbert Walker Bush. And I got to go to the White House when I was a kid to watch my father receive that award, and that really opened my eyes to what government service could be. And that's what led me to go to Washington ultimately many years later and serve in the Bush administration. Here's the thing. Our state is near the bottom, 47th for jobs. We're near the bottom, 46th for education, and we're number one in poverty. And Governor Brown's reelection slogan is the California comeback. Most families that I meet with don't know what he's talking about when he says California comeback. And I believe that someone like me needs to lead the fight to rebuild the middle class through a good education and a good job, putting people back to work. And if a guy like me, young, energized, a lot of experience in Washington, if I'm not willing to try to turn the state around, who's going to do it? And so I feel an obligation to do it.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition, we're talking with California Republican gubernatorial candidate Neel Kashkari. I want to talk about some specific issues now. The Central Valley has been plagued by chronic double-digit unemployment for literally decades, both under Democrats and Republicans in Sacramento. Why do you think that's the case, and how would your administration begin to change that?
Well, I think that part of it, you know, the ag sector is huge. The ag sector is 40% of Central Valley jobs. We've not been investing in water. So droughts are frequent. You know, we're having a drought right now. It's a terrible drought. This is not our first drought. Part of my plan is to cancel the high-speed train, take some of that money, and actually invest in more water storage so we have enough water to feed our farms. So that's part of it. Another thing is we need to transform our schools to make sure kids are getting a good education. I want to enable our parents and teachers to bring vocational training back into the schools. When I travel up and down the Central Valley, I hear about the lack of skilled labor, whether it's welders or machinists or other people to work in these really important jobs. So a lot of those jobs are going unfilled and unemployment is higher. Those are a couple big issues, as well as regulations that are out of control in Sacramento, which is making our ag community, our farm community, much less economically competitive. We need to reform regulations. That'll help small businesses. That'll also help our farmers. And that means it'll put Californians back to work.
You mentioned the plan for high-speed rail. You've called it the crazy train, saying it's too expensive. This is a huge issue here in the Valley. As you mentioned, many ag interests are strongly opposed. However, many in the cities, including your Republican colleague who's running for state controller, Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen, she remains a big supporter of the project. Supporters say it's a way to economically link the cities in the center of the state with the economic engines in the Bay Area and L.A. The price tag for this project keeps going up by another billion just a couple of weeks ago. But isn't that also an argument that if you don't build it now, it's only going to be more expensive later?
Well, look, I'm in favor of mass transit. I'm in favor of connecting our state. It's a question of priorities. spending almost $70 billion on this train does not seem to me to be our highest priority for our finite resources. To me, if I had a choice of building more water storage so we can capture water in the rainy years when there's good snowpack to feed our not just our farms but our entire state in the drought years, that to me seems like a better use of our finite taxpayer dollars than building this train. And so I'm in favor of infrastructure, but we've got to be smart about it. And to me, water comes before the train.
Your opponent in the GOP primary, Tim Donnelly, is running a very populist campaign. He characterizes you as a country club Republican, saying he wants to bring more country to the party. People talk about your time with Goldman Sachs, with the TARP bailout program, and the issue of income inequality comes up. What's your message on income inequality in California and in the nation? You've been on a couple of different sides and seen different perspectives on this.
Yeah, you know, I grew up middle class. My parents were immigrants from India. My first job was bagging groceries. My next job was mowing lawns. I took out loans to go to graduate school. I've lived the American dream coming from a fairly modest background. I lived that dream because I got a good education. The root cause of income inequality in California and in our country is a failure of our education system. When we have a growing economy, people who get a good education, like me, are able to ride that economy up. But if you're stuck in a failing school, you're left behind and income inequality expands. So I am committed to addressing income inequality in California, but that's part of why I am so aggressively tackling education reform to make sure that every kid gets a good education. That's the only way we can lift people up, a good education and a good job.
What are your specific thoughts on education reform? Governor Brown is pursuing this local control funding formula, giving more autonomy on spending dollars to districts in areas that have high English learner percentages and high poverty rates. That's one thing that he's doing. What would your administration do along those lines?
Sure. It's been proven they're just pouring more money into a broken school system does not lead to better results, and Governor Brown is unwilling to make the big changes we need to make. I'm fundamentally changing the way we structure our schools by sending the money right to the school site so parents and teachers can decide how that money is spent. They can bring vocational training back into our schools, and they can decide how to educate our kids, and then we hold them accountable. You know, we spend more than $40 billion a year on K-12, and only about half of that money actually gets into the classroom. I'm going to change all that by putting the money where it's needed in the hands of parents and teachers and empowering them to decide how to educate our kids. You know, what school districts in Fresno need is going to be different than Palo Alto, is going to be different than Los Angeles. There's no way Sacramento can make those decisions. It needs to be made by the parents and teachers so they can meet the needs of our local kids.
What are your thoughts on the Common Core funding, a Common Core curriculum that is so controversial right now? A lot of folks in education are big backers of it, but many parents and others have big concerns about what this means as it's rolling out right now in our classrooms. Is this something that you support, and what do you think about it?
Yeah, I think it really depends on how it's applied. My entire philosophy in education is that the parents and teachers need to decide how to educate our kids. And then there is a role for the state just to check, are the kids learning relative to kids around the country and around the world? And so to me, it's like when I was in high school, I took the SAT. The SAT did not dictate what my teachers taught me, but it was a way for colleges to check, am I on track relative to other kids around the country? So I think having some standard, whether it's Common Core or the California standard, is appropriate. But here's the thing. We're 46 out of 50 states today. We're not hitting the Common Core standard. We're not hitting the California standard. We're not even hitting the Martian standard. So having this big argument over Common Core today, it's like arguing where the three-point line is in a basketball game, and we can't even hit a free throw. I'm making big structural reforms in education, or I want to really change the schools, empower our teachers, empower our parents. Once we get up to top 10, then we can have that's the time to have a more vigorous debate about which set of standards. Right now, it's premature.
We saw a terrible tragedy this past week with the mass shooting near Santa Barbara. You're a gun owner. Most of your party is strongly opposed to new gun control measures. John Fleischman, who runs the influential conservative website Flash Report, wrote in response to these murders that, quote, the Second Amendment exists for a reason. Restricting gun ownership rights fundamentally changes the relationship between the people and our government. How do you see gun control and the Second Amendment coexisting in your view? And what about that role between the people and the government?
So you, as you said, I am a gun owner. I'm a long-term gun owner, and I deeply believe in the Second Amendment. I'm horrified by these tragedies, just like all you are, just like all of your listeners are. But if you just look at this one example, it shows you how tough this is. This is a mental health issue, and I take my gun ownership responsibilities extremely seriously. Adding more gun rules on me is not going to prevent these terrible tragedies. And so we need to focus our attention on the mental health issues that are the root cause of these terrible tragedies. Make sure that, you know, as we continue to understand what happened in this case, make sure that the sheriffs have the tools that they need to investigate, you know, people who, if somebody's parents call and say, we're worried about our son or our daughter, that they might be a danger, we need to make sure that our law enforcement and our mental health professionals have the tools they need to really investigate this. You know, again, we all want to end these tragedies. It's very convenient just to add another gun law, but adding gun laws on me is not going to stop these terrible tragedies, and we need to focus our attention on the root cause, which are mental health issues.
You mentioned a while ago the California economy and regulations. California is in quite a rivalry right now when it comes to economic development with the state of Texas. The move a few weeks ago, the announced move of Toyota from Irvine to Texas is just the latest in those sorts of moves. Tesla right now is also looking for a new location to build its quote-unquote gigafactory. There's talk, though, that California makes it difficult to do that because of the California Environmental Quality Act and the length of time that's needed to analyze the environmental impacts of these sorts of things. The state passes an environmental impact report exemption for a new basketball arena or a new football stadium. But when it comes to economic development, what would your administration do? Is CEQA on the table, looking at how California regulates these big operations? Because this is something that both Democrats and Republicans have looked at but have been unsuccessful so far in coming up with any solution.
Well, you're exactly right. You hit the nail on the head. In fact, in my jobs plan, I specifically make that point. Jerry Brown knows that CEQA stymies development. And so when it's time to build a new basketball arena, he gives them a special treatment. Well, my plan says, okay, Governor Brown, you've come up with this special treatment. If that's good enough for your pet projects, why isn't that good enough for all Californians and all California businesses? So I literally take Governor Brown's expedited review, and I bring that statewide so that all of our businesses and all of our people can benefit from that. If we rein in regulation, we can grow our economy and put people back to work. We need to look at all of these policies through the lens of what does it mean for middle-class families. Today, almost 17% of Californians either have no job or stuck in a part-time job. We're near the bottom in the country. That's not nearly good enough. And if we reform our regulations, not get rid of all of them, but streamline them, we can bring jobs to California. We can put people back to work, which will make our budget so much stronger because we're going to move people from welfare to good jobs where they're paying taxes. We're all going to be better off. We have to do this.
One last question before we go. The issue of fracking is one of the most contentious in Sacramento right now. It's a big issue here in the Central Valley as Kern County is the state's leading oil producer. There's going to be a rally in Taft later this week in support of the oil industry and of fracking. So this is something that a lot of people have concerns about. You talk to farmers in Shafter, and they're very concerned about their groundwater being potentially polluted by fracking operations. Do you where do you stand on that, and do you support the current regulatory scheme that was passed into law last year in terms of tightening regulations but stopping short of a moratorium? What are your views on fracking?
Yeah, fracking has been around for decades and has been done safely for decades in California and around the country. There are a lot of environmental alarmists who are scared, you know, creating scare tactics just to spook people because they want to stop all development, and I don't agree with them. Texas's oil production is up almost 80% in the last 3 years. North Dakota, 100%. California, 3%. We could literally create hundreds of thousands of good jobs and billions of dollars of additional tax revenue. And we need to do this, and we can do it in an environmentally sustainable manner. It's not a choice of either or. We can protect the environment while creating these jobs, and we have to do it to put Californians back to work.
We've been talking with Neel Kashkari, Republican candidate for governor. Neel, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thanks for having me. It's been great.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and find out why some California progressives are less than satisfied with California Governor Jerry Brown in this election season that's coming up next on Valley Edition.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Many people who live in the Fresno area say water isn't flowing from their taps like it used to. Some households using private groundwater wells are finding the water table is falling below their pumps during the drought. Pauline Bartolone reports from Fresno on the people those homeowners call when the water runs out.
Arthur and Orem drills new water wells for farmers and homeowners in the Fresno area. The company's Kim Hammond says phones have been ringing off the hook.
It's just panic in their voice when they call because they've woke up in the morning and they don't have any water.
Hi, Ruth. This is Kim. How are you?
I know. I can hear it in your voice.
Hammond says she has more bad news for the people on the phone. There's an 8 to 9 month wait, and new wells can cost $17,000 or more.
As I'm giving the people the information, they're telling me their sad stories as to, I've got $10,000 worth of landscaping. What am I going to do? I don't know.
Fresno County says twice the number of wells are being drilled this year compared to last. And Hammond says, yes, the well drilling business is booming, but it can be overwhelming.
Because we only have so many rigs, and we are drilling deeper than ever before, and we're encountering things that we've never encountered.
Environmental advocates say the state does not adequately manage who is using groundwater and how much. They say overdrawing the underground supply can cause the ground to sink and lead to inequities in water access. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
Most political pundits expect California Governor Jerry Brown to win a record fourth term this fall, but that doesn't mean he's universally popular with his fellow Democrats. There is growing frustration among progressives over what they see as the governor's fiscal conservatism and business-friendly views. Ben Adler has more from Sacramento in our final report in our three-part series on California's June gubernatorial primary.
We're going to say something very symbolic to our governor right now.
Yes, symbolism. Jerry Brown loves it. At his January State of the State address, he passed out playing cards with his dog Sutter, saying, "Bark if you don't like deficits." At a recent Capitol rally, a coalition of progressive groups had its own symbolic gesture for the governor, who wants to set aside California's revenue surge in a rainy day fund.
Everyone got their umbrellas?
Yeah!
We're going to open them all together and then chant, "Ready? It's raining now! It's raining now!"
It's raining now is the response from liberals inside and outside the Capitol when confronted with Brown's budget proposals this year, particularly his efforts to create a rainy day fund, hold a tight line on new spending, and pay down debt. Catherine McMichael Scott came up to the Capitol from Oakland.
I don't like it, period, and I don't like what he's doing to the seniors. Okay, because we're losing a lot of things that we need.
From CalWORKs to early childhood education, child care to in-home care, the governor has opposed restoring money to safety net programs that took deep cuts during the recession. He made the point in releasing his updated budget proposal, known inside the Capitol as the May Revise.
A lot of ideas around Sacramento and throughout the Assembly and Senate halls around the state to do things. Well, we have to recognize we've done a lot already, and we haven't paid for all that we've already done.
I think there is a level of frustration.
That's California Federation of Teachers President Joshua Peschtold.
While we're not in opposition to that, you can't just put money aside for that to the exclusion of restoring programs that really benefit the neediest Californians.
Many Democratic lawmakers agree. Here's Senate Budget Committee Chair Mark Leno.
It is raining cats and dogs for so many who have seen services upon which they and their families depend for their very existence today.
But it's not just Brown's budgets that have provoked progressives.
We're back again, and we're coming back, and we're coming back. Governor Brown, listen. Listen to what we're saying. No more fracking. No more freaking fracking.
Brown has been dogged all year by anti-fracking protesters. They even interrupted his speech at the California Democratic Party convention. He's also worked to streamline the California Environmental Quality Act to speed up certain development projects. Many environmentalists are not pleased. Here's the Sierra Club's Catherine Phillips.
Their view about Jerry Brown is less enthusiastic than it used to be. That being said, I don't think any of them would think to vote for the people that are running against him this round.
See, as much as progressives might be frustrated with the governor, it's not like he faces any political risk. He's widely expected to win re-election this fall. So the question for liberals is how to respond. Labor leader Willie Pelote says Brown clearly deserves another term, but
there are things that maybe the governor will push back on, and we will push back as well. That we feel very strongly that the legislature and the administration should embrace now. And when that time happens, and if the governor is not willing to work with us on it, we will fight.
Still, the governor's fiscal conservative streak could come at a cost. Los Angeles community organizer Ariana Alcaraz campaigned for Brown 4 years ago, not this year.
I probably would step away from even identifying myself as any political party. You know, Jerry Brown claims to be a Democrat, yet he's running on Republican conservative values.
Brown has famously compared governing to paddling a canoe. A little to the left, then a little to the right. That philosophy is why he's heavily favored to win a record fourth term this fall. But some Californians on the left bank of the river believe their Democratic governor is too far offshore. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Earlier this month, the Obama administration released the names of 55 colleges and universities under investigation for their handling of sexual assault complaints. In this edition of FM89's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State Communication Professor Diane Blair says a culture change in this area will require education and a lot more.
Recently, the White House issued new guidelines and expectations to combat sexual violence on college campuses. The measures call for better survey data about the extent of the problem, more transparency regarding university enforcement, and increased support for survivors of sexual assault and harassment. The statistics are startling. 1 in 4 sexual assaults occur on college campuses. 20 to 25% of college women experience rape or attempted rape. Freshmen and sophomores face the most sexual assault, and students who live in sorority houses are 3 times more likely to be raped than students who live off campus. Alcohol is involved in the majority of college rapes, and 80 to 90% of college sexual assaults involve people who are acquaintances. In a 20-year study of college men, 1 in 16 admitted that they had used physical force to have sexual intercourse, or had had sex with someone who was too incapacitated by alcohol or drugs to resist. Sexual violence is also an underreported crime for several reasons, and more than 40% of rape victims who didn't report their attacks said they feared retaliation by the attacker or others. This occurs in a context where students found responsible for sexual assault on campus often face little or no punishment. Rarely are rapists expelled from college, even in cases involving repeat offenders. More frequently, victims of sexual violence find their own lives disrupted, and many drop out of school due to a lack of institutional support and fear of reprisal for reporting the violence. College administrators often place their university's reputation above acknowledging the danger lurking on their campuses. The Department of Education recently released a list of 55 colleges under investigation for violations of Title IX and the Clery Act for their handling of sexual violence on their campuses. The list includes community colleges, statewide universities, and Ivy League schools, demonstrating that the problem is widespread. Administrators argue that sexual violence is a complicated issue that frequently has no witnesses and a victim who wants to remain anonymous. Additionally, a lot of students don't know what constitutes sexual assault or consent. In a recent speech, the president of Dartmouth admitted that binge drinking has become the rule and not the exception on college campuses. And students who engage in alcohol and substance abuse are at an increased risk for sexual assault. Maybe these new federal requirements will encourage increased awareness among administrators and students alike, but it is just a start. In addition to empowering the victims of these crimes, we also need a better understanding of the perpetrators, of whom the vast majority are men. In addition to better reporting and enforcement measures, preventative measures are also needed. That means asking important questions like, what are the prevalent attitudes and behaviors on college campuses that normalize and excuse sexual assault? And how can the campus culture be changed? In an environment dedicated to knowledge and achievement, education about this issue is still sorely lacking. For The Moral Is, I'm Diane Blair.
This past weekend, thousands of people made the trek to Yosemite Valley from around the world to marvel at the majesty of Yosemite Falls, El Capitan, and Half Dome. But just miles north, Yosemite's little sister, Hetch Hetchy Valley, sits submerged, a tribute to the 20th century's quest for man to dominate and even destroy nature in the name of progress. A new book by author Kenneth Brower, Hetch Hetchy, Undoing a Great American Mistake, tells the story of how the city of San Francisco destroyed this wonder of Yosemite National Park and the effort to bring it back. Mr. Brower joins us now on Valley Edition. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
I understand the push to dam the Tuolumne at Hetch Hetchy Valley actually began as a result of the San Francisco earthquake. Can you tell me a little more about how this effort began?
Yes, this was sort of the propaganda put out by the city of San Francisco. They used the 1906 quake as an excuse for Hetch Hetchy, saying that we needed a reliable source of water to fight the kind of fire that consumed the city after the quake. Well, it was really completely irrelevant. No source of water would have helped San Francisco. All the water mains were broken, gas mains were broken. That's what caused the fire. No matter where you got your water, that fire would have happened. So it was really just a sort of rationale to help San Francisco get this water.
Certainly there were voices against this push. Tell me a little more about the mood of the time when this was proposed.
Very interesting. It was something I learned in the course of doing this research that I hadn't known before. This was a huge battle in the history of environmentalism. It absolutely preoccupied the whole nation. And what it really was a fight of the city of San Francisco really against the whole rest of the country. And if you read the editorials from the early teens, in wonderful New York Times editorials against this act, which was to impound water within a national park for a commercial purpose for the benefit of one city. And the whole nation, really, even get 40 miles away from San Francisco, and people were, and Californians were against this because they recognized that Yosemite National Park was theirs, and it belonged to the whole nation. And for it to be sort of preempted by one city made everybody mad. I suspect Fresno felt the same way. I know there was a lot of, if you read the old editorials in Sacramento papers back then, and Los Angeles papers especially, you realize that not only was the nation against this idea, but much of California was against it.
Now,
this fight was really almost a prototypic environmentalist battle. John Muir and William Colby and all the Sierra Club people who had sort of organized against this take of the national park was really orchestrated the first campaign. They got the press interested. They wrote books. They brought people to the site so that the place would have a constituency of people who knew what was there and who cared about it. And in the end, they lost, but only because San Francisco did a better job of lobbying than they did.
Now, folks who remember Hetch Hetchy before it was dammed are unfortunately no longer with us today. But can you describe what Hetch Hetchy Valley was like and what one would see if one goes there today?
What Muir described it as is the second Yosemite, and it really was. It was eerily similar to Yosemite Valley, not quite as beautiful. You're sort of exaggerated there, but almost a real second Yosemite. It's odd that the landforms even sort of echo Yosemite. In Hetch Hetchy, there's an equivalent of El Capitan, and there's sort of in Kolana Rock in Hetch Hetchy, there's an equivalent of Cathedral Rocks or maybe Sentinel Rock in Yosemite. So the valley even follows sort of the same course. It was covered then by meadow at the bottom and forest, and it is now underwater. And when that water falls, there's a bathtub ring all the way around. In 1954, my father ran up to, when the water was very low, it was a 180-foot bathtub ring around the thing. It was not at all the beautiful lake that the San Francisco Advertiser.
Again, if you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with Kenneth Brower. He's the author of Hetch Hetchy, Undoing a Great American Mistake. Much of your book is dedicated to telling the story of how Hetch Hetchy was constructed, the political context of the day. There's some wonderful archival footage of Hetch Hetchy Valley before the dam, its construction, and the flora and fauna of the region. You also spend a great deal of time in this book talking about the path forward, and it's underscored in your subtitle, Undoing a Great American Mistake. We have seen dams removed in places across the country, including here in California. Hetch Hetchy remains a most controversial project. A few years ago, there was a issue on the ballot in the city of San Francisco for voters to ask for a feasibility study that failed. San Francisco prides itself on its progressivism and sustainability. Do you think San Francisco voters will ever come to terms with the seeming incongruity between their environmental goals and where their water comes from?
Well, that's a beautifully worded question, and it's a good one. I don't know, because San Francisco, for one thing, the pro-Hetch Hetchy forces, pro-dam Hetch Hetchy forces, will always outspend the environmental people who want to see this happen. There's another question, of course, is maybe we don't just go to San Francisco to get a resolution of this, because we know where people seem to have stood on this issue. It really is an issue for the whole nation. It's not Yosemite is the nation's park, and in fact, it has always been San Francisco against the rest of the nation. So I think maybe we spend less of our energy in San Francisco and more around the country to try to get this really big mistake reversed.
What would a path forward look like? You talk about a number of different alternatives and restoration, removal of the dam. It seems like any solution would have to make sure that there's still adequate water supplies for the city of San Francisco through some sort of means, and then certainly restoration of the habitat. In addition to removal of the dam, what would a path forward look like? Do we have an idea of what it would cost, and is it even feasible?
The cost estimates are all over the lot. The one option would be just to breach the dam and leave it. Not a desirable one to most people, but it would be an interesting monument to man's hubris to have this sort of a pyramid out there to show the mistake we once made. I think most people would rather see the dam go. It's easy to impound the water further downstream. San Francisco still would have access, and the plans that environmentalists have offered would still have access to Omni River water. It would just not be impounded in National Park. You'd impound it downstream in Don Pedro or other stories downstream. It would cost something to get rid of this. It was a wonderful piece of technology when it was designed. It's gravity-fed, so that water doesn't require pumps to get all the way down to San Francisco. It's a beautiful engineering scheme for its time. We're in a new time now, and we're in a time when lots of dams are coming out, none as big as this yet. But even the Bureau of Reclamation, our nation's great dam builders, has begun to see a rationale for taking bad dams out, dams that cause more damage than good. And many hundreds have been coming out around the nation. So that's sort of the way I see forward. This would be just another dam in that process of freeing rivers again. We have so few free-flowing rivers left in the United States, and there's this movement to get them flowing again, and it's a noble effort. Part of the end of the book, I had fun just trying to imagine what it would be like when Hetch Hetchy comes back. My own wish would be that we just let the river restore itself. There's a lot of people who would like to do hands-on restoration, and I think my own belief is that the river itself would bring back the organisms that need to be there, and we've seen that ecosystems are resilient, and I suspect that the valley would restore itself very quickly. A few species would need help. Maybe the black oaks there would need to be seeded, but otherwise stuff will come in. All the animals that used to use that flowing river would come back. All the birds that use the riparian habitat that would be restored would come back, and it would be a wonderful experiment to be around to observe.
Do you think Hetch Hetchy, the construction of this dam nearly a century ago, also maybe had an unintended consequence in adding even more momentum to the environmental movement that is still so powerful today?
That's another good observation, and it's true. I think it really this defeat of Nero and his friends in the Sierra Club really led to, really ended up by empowering that organization to become the most powerful environmental organization in the country. And that kind of defeat hardens people, and they learn from their lesson. In later dam fights, later fights against bad dams in the Southwest and dams proposed for Grand Canyon and Dinosaur National Monument, the Sierra Club won. And I think they won out of a resolution that was sort of hardened in the crucible of that early fight for Hetch Hetchy. So, yes, I think it not only sort of empowered the Sierra Club, but the whole nation determined that this wasn't going to happen again. And, in fact, in 1916, 3 years after the Raker Act, which allowed this dam to happen, we had our national park system in place, which in many ways was a response to this violation of our first national park, which is really Yosemite. So there were good effects of this loss.
Again, our guest today has been Kenneth Brower. He is the author of the new book, Hetch Hetchy, Undoing a Great American Mistake. It chronicles the construction of San Francisco's O'Shaughnessy Dam in Yosemite National Park, damming the Tuolumne River and inundating what many called a second Yosemite Valley. The book is available now on Heyday Books. Mr. Brower, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And we go from the San Joaquin River, or rather from the Tuolumne River, to the San Joaquin River now for our final segment of Valley Edition today. Dave Kaler from the San Joaquin River Parkway and Conservation Trust joins us. Dave, welcome.
Thank you, Joe. It's good to be here.
You have a series of readings by local authors and poets that continues this week and throughout the summer months into October. It's called The Respite by the River. It's a relaxed evening out at the River Center. Tell us what's coming up here on Thursday, May 29th.
Yeah, we're really proud of our Respite by the River series. And this Thursday, Gary Soto joins us on the 29th, which is Friday.
Yes.
Yes, the 29th. It's Friday, and Gary Soto is joining us, and it's really great to have him. He has, of course, being a Valley native and the incredible poet and writer that he is, has really woven it, his writings into the culture here, and it's really great to have him. So just to clarify, May 29th is Thursday, and I'm going to be in big trouble with my folks if I don't correct that. So it's May 29th, this Thursday, out at the River Center.
Now, you've already had some events earlier this year. You had James Tyner, Fresno's Poet Laureate, on Tuesday, April 8th, but you have some other great authors coming up and poets.
Yeah, the next two after Gary Soto, Philip Levine, and then Margarita Engel. Philip Levine is joining us on June 11th, and then Margarita Engel is joining us on July 17th.
Are these writers, poets, speaking specifically about the river in any way, or is it about the valley? Is there a theme?
They bring the writings that they want to read and interact, usually there's always some connection made there. But really, this is the artists, the poets, the writers' evening to connect with the community. And one of the great things I think about Respite by the River is, in addition to the readings, they will interject with stories and connect with the audience in a really special way. And you get to know these authors and these very creative people in a much different way than you might otherwise be able to do.
And this is a free event, as I understand it.
Yeah, it is. It is a free event. We have been very fortunate to have sponsors like Valley Public Radio, as well as PBS and the Educational Credit Union help sponsor this. So folks are coming out with the support of the trust and our supporters, and the event is free.
Yeah, and again, the Roosevelt High School Latin Jazz and Mariachi Bands will be there on Thursday night to set the scene for right. Gary Soto's reading.
And my understanding is that Gary Soto is a Roosevelt grad, so then the connection with the two bands there will be kind of nice.
Yes, indeed, a Fresno City College grad as well. The Respite by the River series is great. You can find more information at riverparkway.org, but you have other programs going on right now that parents and others might want to know about, the River Camp series.
Well, River Camp, we're in high season of registering for River Camp right now. And River Camp has become one of our flagship programs where kids get to have a week-long series of day camp out at the San Joaquin River. And we now hold River Camp in two or three different settings, the largest one being our partnership with Fresno County Office of Ed and at Scout Island. But we do a science camp for girls at Sycamore Island and some other venues on the river. One of the really fun things for us is about 2 years ago, we were fortunate to be able to take River Camp on the road and brought it to Firebaugh for a couple of weeks, and then last year, 4 weeks. And this will be our third year now of bringing River Camp to Firebaugh. And we've worked with the communities of Mendota and Firebaugh to hire seasonal staff from those communities that help them put on River Camp right there at the community center at Firebaugh. And that's really been a very neat thing for us to be able to do.
That has to be great for those kids. They live right next to the river, yet very few of them ever get to experience.
Yeah, those communities, incredibly high unemployment rate, very low income and underserved. And so being able to give these kids that kind of opportunity to be, it's creating, it's changing lives and creating memories for those kids. And in fact, we have a crowdfunding thing out on the web that folks could help with on Indiegogo. But if you just Googled San Joaquin River, Firebaugh, River Camp or something, you'd hit our Indiegogo crowdfunding site.
Great. Again, Dave Kaler joining us today from the River Parkway. For the Respite by the River, if people want more information or just want to go, what should they do?
Well, it's this Thursday, May 29th, and just go to our website, riverparkway.org. The evening gets underway at 6. Bring a lawn chair, your favorite picnic blanket. There's wine and desserts this coming Thursday night. Again, entry's free.
Again, Dave Kaler with the San Joaquin River Parkway and Conservation Trust. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe.
Well, that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, let us know what you think. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, or send us a tweet at KVPR. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.